everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have Kevin Kenny on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, Peaceable Kingdom Lost, The Paxton Boys and the Destruction of William Penn's Holy Experiment. William Penn was a Quaker, as you probably know, and he went to the New World in order to create a kind of religious utopia, one in which the Europeans would get along with one another and, of course, with the Native Americans who were there. It didn't turn out that way, as Kevin shows in this book, and it's a very interesting story of ideals running up against reality, because it was actually really hard to do what William Penn and the Quakers wanted to do in 18th century Pennsylvania. There were many, many conflicting interests. Anyway, I enjoyed talking to Kevin today, and I'm sure that you'll enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Marshall. Good morning.
How are you today?
I am well, thank you.
Good. And you are in Boston, Massachusetts, is that correct?
Boston, Massachusetts, yes.
That's right. Are you mourning the death of Edward Kennedy today?
Well, it's a huge event here.
I bet it is, yeah. I bet it is.
Ongoing, yeah.
So you're at BC. Is there anything special going on there?
Nothing planned yet because we're not in session yet. We don't really open up in the Northeast, or at least in Boston, until actually after Labor Day.
Oh, is that right? That's amazing. Yeah, yeah. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Kevin Kenny right now, who's in Boston and teaches at Boston College, and we'll be discussing his terrific new book, Peaceable Kingdom Lost, The Paxton Boys and the Destruction of William Penn's Holy Experiment. As all of you know who listen to New Books in History, I've read this book, and as I told Kevin in the pre-interview, it's a terrific book. It's extraordinarily well-researched. It's very well-written. It's quite a page-turner, and it's also really sad because, as Kevin I'm sure will tell you, it really is a terrific example of good intentions gone awry, kind of running into circumstances and breaking up on the rocky shoals of, I guess, what I'd call human nature. But in any event, Kevin, let me ask you to begin the interview by just saying a few words about yourself, where you're from, where you went to school, and that kind of thing.
I'm a native of Dublin, raised in Dublin, educated in Scotland as an undergraduate at the University of Edinburgh, and then I moved over, came to the United States actually as an undergraduate for a year, got very interested in American history, and then decided to do the PhD in American history. It made most sense to come back to the United States, obviously, to do that, and I took the PhD at Columbia University, studying American history. Jim Shenton was the historian of immigration. Eric Foner, the great historian of the 19th century and the Civil War. Barbara Fields. Those faculty had a formative influence on my training.
And at that point, did you? How did you get to BC?
I got to BC by traveling 2,000 miles south. my first job was at the University of Texas at Austin.
Uh-huh.
So I was trained in American labor and immigration history, and I had a position as assistant professor in that field at the University of Texas for 5 years. And then position opened up at Boston College, which was quite attractive to me, a more senior position. So I took a circuitous route from New York to Boston and back.
I see. So you wrote a number of books prior to this one. Maybe you could say a few words about those.
Yeah, the first book I wrote was called Making Sense of the Molly Maguires, and that was a history of immigrant workers in the Pennsylvania anthracite fields during the period of Civil War and Reconstruction. Another tragic story in many respects was the story of 20 young immigrant workers who were actually executed. They had been convicted of a series of murders or assassinations going back through the 1870s and the 1860s, and they were thought to have been members of a secret society called the Molly Maguires. Now, I know a fair bit about Irish history as well as American history, and it was a way of bringing those two together, because what I saw happening in Pennsylvania was a sort of a rare transatlantic outgrowth of a form of popular protest that I recognized from the Irish countryside that ended up being transplanted into, of all places, the heartland of the American Industrial Revolution. So it was an odd sort of juxtaposition of old world popular protest and new world industrial conditions, and that was the story of the Molly Maguire. So that was the first book I wrote. That was followed by a more general history of the American Irish from 1700 to the present. That's a sort of a narrative survey book that's used in immigration history courses. I also edited a book on Ireland and the British Empire in the Oxford series, the general history of the British Empire, which was interesting. So most of the work I've done has sort of bridged an Atlantic divide and has tried to deal with both sides of the Atlantic simultaneously. The new book, less so, although there are some Irish antecedents and there are Ulster Presbyterians in particular at the heart of the story, I think it is, in the end, a very American story. Mm-hmm. And the European origins of the story I tell are actually less important than the Native American history. And then, of course, it's a story also about British imperial history, early British imperial history, and the struggle for mastery between England and France over North America. But very, very much a story that unfolds on this side of the Atlantic.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this. How did you come to write the book? How did you shift from, let's say, the Molly Maguires or these more general studies to this particular topic, the Paxton Boys? How did you discover them, or how did you decide that would be a good treatment for a, or a good subject for a monograph?
Well, in a couple of ways. The first is that after I'd written the history of the Molly Maguires, which is a micro history in the sense that it's a very detailed study of the anthracite region of Pennsylvania, but it's set in a broad Atlantic context because it takes in the Irish antecedents. After I'd written that, I thought for a while of writing, if you like, a prehistory of these popular protest movements that would start in the mid-18th century, take the story through groups like the Regulators, the Whiskey Rebels, and then on into various gangs and secret societies that emerged among immigrant workers in the antebellum period. I thought of doing that for a long time. I was going to call it Midnight Legislators, a title I still want to use, at least for an article, if not for a book.
I was going to say, that's definitely worth hanging on to.
Yeah, the title alone was driving it. That's a term that the authorities used in the countryside to describe the nocturnal activities of the secret societies. They went out after dark. They often wore disguise, which, of course, is how the Molly Maguires themselves got their name. So I looked into that for a while. I found, actually, that trying to collapse the 18th century and the 19th century into the same story wasn't all that helpful, because the differences between the periods were too great. The essential difference is that in the 18th century, popular protest tended to be much more open and legitimate. In the 19th century, as a generalization, it tends to be driven underground, becomes more secret, it becomes more violent. So I became interested then in the 18th century on its own terms. I thought about the Paxton Boys, which we'll discuss this morning, the Regulators in the Carolinas, the Whiskey Rebels, thought about doing all of them together, but then became just intrigued by the one story of the Paxton Boys, but putting it in a different context, and that was a context that went back in time. So to tell the story of the Paxton Boys, I go back all the way to the beginning of Pennsylvania with William Penn, and I take the story through the American Revolution. So it's actually a book that covers a century of history rather than, if you like, an ocean of space. So that's the first thing that the way I got interested. The other is that I have a particular interest in trying to write history that will be read outside as well as inside universities. Mm-hmm. And I think I accomplished that with the Molly Maguire book and with this Peaceable Kingdom Lost. And so I like to write history in such a way that I am analyzing the past, but in a way that is accessible to as many readers as possible. Very effective way of doing that for me is to find stories. Mm-hmm. And stories about change over time, mm-hmm. Stories often that have inherent drama or tragedy. I used to like to say of the Molly Maguires that only the most talented historian could kill off all of the inherent drama in the story. You'd have to try really hard to tell a bad story about the Molly Maguires. And again, I believe that you can. I believe that telling engaging human stories of change over time can also be a way of explaining very important things about the past. So I'm on the lookout for stories that I can tell. Now, often these are discrete and particular stories. At the heart of the new book is an Indian massacre, mm-hmm. But to make sense of the origin, significance, and impact of that event, then I place it in successively broader chronological and spatial contexts. Mm-hmm. So that's really the type of history I like to write.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you've done it wonderfully here. I know it's. I've tried my hand at it a little bit, and I failed utterly. But I certainly respect people that can do it. And obviously, this entire program is about disseminating knowledge about books like yours, in the hopes that people will read serious history. And this is very serious and very interesting history. I'm always reminded of what they said in the Renaissance about telling anyone anything, and that is that you should please and instruct simultaneously. But it's hard to
please
keep both. Please and instruct. Those are hard balls to keep in the air simultaneously. But I like what you said about starting at the beginning, because I'm not an American historian, and I will admit to you that I don't know as much as I should about all this stuff. But why don't we begin at the beginning, and you tell us about William Penn and how he and his family got a hold of Pennsylvania.
Yes, and that's an extraordinary story in itself. William Penn emerges as one of the more laudable and attractive figures in the book. There aren't that many. Benjamin Franklin does rather well, too. Several of the Native American leaders do. Penn is a Quaker. He is a sincere and committed Quaker. He believes that he can put into practice an ideal harmonious society, which he calls his Peaceable Kingdom. And, of course, the book is called Peaceable Kingdom Lost. The Peaceable Kingdom would be a society in which Europeans of many different backgrounds and the Native American inhabitants of Pennsylvania could live together in harmony. And this was Penn's ideal. Now, it's an attractive ideal, to some extent a successful one. At the same time, we need to realize the colonial foundations of what Penn was doing in order to understand maybe some of the contradictions, maybe why it couldn't fully work in the end. The first thing to understand is that there would have been no Pennsylvania if the king hadn't given William Penn 29 million acres of land to play around with. Mm-hmm. That we have to pause at that and realize what that means. It makes him the largest individual landlord in the British Empire. We also realize, of course, from our perspective, that there were people living on that land who used it in particular ways that were central to their culture, who they owned it in particular ways that are very different from English law, but they were, of course, not consulted as part of this deal. Now, Penn stands out because he is genuinely interested in the culture of the different Native American or Indian groups who live there. He treats them as individual sovereign entities. He doesn't lump all Indians into the same category. That comes later in American history. He makes treaties with the groups individually, and he purchases land from them. In other words, he compensates them for the land on which they live, which he desires to own in an absolute and English legal sense. So again, all of that is commendable and unusual by the standards of the time. At the same time, we need to qualify it a little bit in realizing that Penn had a fair degree of self-interest in purchasing the land fairly and above board, because in doing so, he could clear the land of previous titles and encumbrances and sell it to settlers. Mm-hmm. So it's a mixture of self-interest and altruism, and altruism, of course, often is self-interest that we encounter here. But the important thing with Penn is that he respects the Indians. He is genuinely interested in them. He makes treaties with them. For the most part, they revere him. And he sets up a land system whereby all land must be bought and sold through the Penn family dealing with the Indians, not by individual settlers who are either attempting to purchase land outside that system. Mm-hmm. Now, that's his goal. That's his ideal for various reasons that we'll discuss at greater length. It doesn't work and perhaps can't work.
What was his idea, to populate this land with European settlers?
Yes, in a well-regulated way. He and Benjamin Franklin and others use a significant term, little commonwealths is the term they use, and that is to describe the harmonious coexistence of European settlers and Indians. The Indians will remain on their own land in their little commonwealths among us. That's mm-hmm. a phrase that's used at the time. Not only wants, but needs European settlers to come because they will purchase the land from him, and he will begin to recoup the expenses involved in setting up his colony. Penn is always chronically in debt. He actually goes into a debtor's prison at one point. He has a well-regulated vision of how that should be done. But of course, even the Quaker settlers, when they come, do not want to settle in little nucleated English villages around the town of Philadelphia. They want to move a little further west and get on the best, most fertile land. Mm-hmm. And then when settlers begin to arrive from the Northern Irish province of Ulster, they just bypass Penn and his system altogether, and they move west to what was then the frontier. It was referred to as the frontier, and that's in the region of Lancaster and present-day Harrisburg in the Susquehanna Valley. Mm-hmm. That is the western frontier of settlement, almost up to the Revolution, up to the 1760s. And basically, settlers just go straight out there and claim the land by what they call tomahawk right. you take a tomahawk and you carve your initials or your symbol into a tree, and it's yours.
I see.
Now, in total disregard of what Penn wants, and in total disregard of the Indians who live there.
Uh-huh. I see. So there was a third group here as well, the Germans that he invited. Maybe you could talk a little bit about them.
Most commentators that we read in the 18th century compare the Germans and the so-called Scotch-Irish or Scots-Irish. That's the Irish of Ulster, Scottish Presbyterian background, who mm-hmm. came from Ulster to Pennsylvania. They compare them, and invariably the Scots-Irish come out adversely from the comparison. The Germans come out well. Broadly speaking, the Germans settle on Lancaster Plain, which is between Philadelphia and current-day Lancaster, some of the most fertile land in America, some of the most fertile land on Earth. They arrive with sufficient resources and sufficient agricultural skill to be able to do that, mm-hmm. so they can purchase the land and they can set up as moderate to large-scale farmers. as you move west out of the Lancaster Plain, and you can see it even today if you drive. I was down there in a rental car just a couple of months ago and confirming all the things I knew from history 250 years ago. As you drive towards the river, you begin to drive uphill into hill country. Mm-hmm. That's where trouble begins. The land is much poorer, it's an uphill gradient, it's more densely wooded and eventually forested, and then you move into mountainous territory. Mm-hmm. And it's in that region that the Ulster Scots tend to settle without permit. They settle there as squatters whenever they can. They don't have to pay rents, they don't have to purchase the land. They're immediately in conflict with the Indians. They are on the frontier. And of course, the dynamic between the two is fascinating because the Scots-Irish and the squatters borrow Native American agricultural techniques, what we would call slash and burn, mm-hmm. or girdling trees rather than cutting them down, mm-hmm. you know, where you remove a strip of bark, mm-hmm. A strip of bark to interrupt the sap flow, and the tree dies so that it allows sufficient sunlight in that you can grow crops just for a season. Mm-hmm. And then you move on. They also wear moccasins. They also put tar in their hair and wear beaver skin hats and everything. And so from the perspective of the civilized Quakers in the East, they looked like what? They looked like Indians, mm-hmm. and which is absolutely infuriating to them to ever be compared mm-hmm. to the group that they're in conflict with. And Benjamin Franklin, in a famous phrase in his pamphlet against the Paxton Boys, ends up calling them Christian white savages.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the type of cultural exchange we're dealing with. They feel also out in the West that the Eastern elite looks down on them, mm-hmm. Much like they had felt in Ireland that the Anglican elite had looked down on them. They see themselves and really are a buffer between an oppressed group. It's Catholic in Ireland. It's, oppressed isn't the best word, but between an upper and a lower group. Mm-hmm. You have an Anglican elite in Ireland. You have a Quaker elite in Pennsylvania. You have a buffer group of these Scots-Irish frontiersmen on both sides of the Atlantic. Below them, they're keeping down Catholics in Ireland. They're mm-hmm. keeping down Indians in Pennsylvania. It's a remarkable sort of embattled, restless, mobile, aggressive culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's interesting. Why? Let me ask a quick question. Were most of the Germans who came, were they Mennonites, or were they Lutherans, or were they both?
Both. Couldn't give you exact figures mm-hmm. off the top of my head, though they're in the book.
I can't remember either.
I can't come through. They wouldn't mostly have been Mennonites.
Yeah.
There were Amish. There were Mennonites. There were Lutherans. It's funny, there isn't really a pan-German identity mm-hmm. Because they not only do they belong to different religions and come from different regions and speak different dialects, they often want to be left alone. Mm-hmm. And by definition, some of the Mennonite and Amish groups are self-contained and want no interaction even mm-hmm. with other Germans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the actual breakdown, I don't have.
I just was wondering. Yeah. The reason I ask is we have Mennonite and Amish communities out here in Iowa around Iowa City, and we visit them sometimes. And I just was kind of interested.
Yeah. They're the best. The Mennonites and Amish would be the best known of the Germans in Lancaster, but not necessarily the most numerous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I know that Germantown figures prominently in the book.
I think
most people know about Germantown these days because it's an extraordinarily large mall. I don't know if you've heard
yes,
of
that. Yeah,
gigantic mall that everybody from Philadelphia goes to. The Ulstermen, I don't know if they were called Ulstermen at the time, but the folks from Ulster, why did they come over? How were they convinced to come over to this rough country?
Well, they came over for the same reason that their own ancestors had come into the north of Ireland from Scotland, and that was in hopes of securing land that they could call their own. Mm-hmm. It's all about land.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Ulster, they never properly secured that goal because they tended to be tenant farmers rather than land owners. One way of owning land in a brutally direct way is just to expropriate it,
mm-hmm.
to take it away from its native inhabitants. And they did that and set up claims and then might have eventually legalized those claims. It's a chaotic place.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a phrase in the book where the generation before the Paxton Boys strike, a group of Ulster squatters try to take over the land on which the same Conestoga Indians are living under the protection of the Penn family. And they say that they say that it is wrong that land be left idle when it's needed by hungry Christians.
So
from their point of view, land that is not being put to the same type of productive use that they could put it in order to feed themselves, grow crops, perhaps produce a small cash crop or two, is idle. It's uncultivated land is idle.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever lays claim to that land and can produce value out of the land by working the land is justified in owning that land as property.
Mm-hmm.
So from their point of view, the land is not used. It is populated by heathens who are putting it to no productive use and therefore have no claim to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that it should just be taken over. Now, from the point of view of the Penn family, the land ultimately belongs to the Penn family because they're simultaneously landlords and proprietors of the province. From the point of view of most of the Indians, the very concept of land ownership as absolute private property is nonsensical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I know that
it's a very tangled situation.
Yeah, you said that the Penn family. It's one of the things you say in the book, and this was sort of interesting, is that the Indians sell the same piece of land several times.
Yeah, and the Penns go along with that. I think it's very revealing. We don't know for certain, but all the signs are that land was held as a tribal trust. It wasn't held in individual allotments, that the notion of the English notion of absolute land ownership, which could be forfeited or alienated in return for land or goods,
mm-hmm.
is not one that makes sense to most Indians. They're not interested in land as property, as a source of revenue. They're interested in land as that which sustains life,
mm-hmm.
and there's a fair amount of reverence for the land and what the land contains in terms mm-hmm. of its crops and animals. Now, the Penn family will purchase land from the Indians. The Iroquois, who we'll talk about, I'm sure, are major players mm-hmm. in this. Any such purchase has to be ratified by the tribe or nation in council.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be formally ratified in order to be binding, but it's still the idea of transferring absolute title over land in this way is still a very odd one for the Indians. And one clear sign we have of this is on multiple occasions they will sell a piece of land and then they will approach the Penn family half a generation or a generation later and say, you know what, we're going to sell you that piece of land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, I document in the book some cases where the same piece of land is sold over and over again and the Penn family will go along with this.
Yeah.
And if you read the sources, there'll be a gentle admonition, which will be, well, look, you know, your forefathers did sign a deed giving us this land in 1737 or 1686, but we'll give you £500 again, mm-hmm. and the land is ours again, but really it's ours.
Uh-huh. Right,
so there's a huge cultural gulf there.
Well, it's funny because I know that in the case of many universities, and the one I'm thinking about in particular is there's a famous university in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you may have heard of, that will occasionally, or two actually, but one of them gives the city of Cambridge a big lump sum payment every year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So in a sense, Cambridge is selling them the land in which this famous university is
every year. Every year. Yeah.
And if they don't surrender that payment, I figure that these people at this famous university are going to suffer. So it's not...
Land title is not something you want to investigate too closely.
It may be
legal, but it's still fictitious.
That's
some basic sense.
Right. So then, one of the things I really liked about the book, and I think that readers will find most interesting, is the attention you pay not to lump the Indians into one category. And that is, you know, we have a Native American historian here who beats that drum, so to say, very often. And I really liked how you showed that the Indians themselves were not exactly they were neither peaceable with one another, nor did they have the same interests. So maybe you could talk a little about that.
Yeah, and I think you had mentioned at the outset that in some ways this is a sad book. It's certainly a tragic book, and Native American history often is. I mean, I think part of the tragedy here is that by the end of the story, which is the American Revolution, Americans are lumping all Indians into one category. And it's a grimly familiar category, which is that all Indians are the same, and to prefigure the 19th century saying that the only good Indian ultimately is a dead Indian. It's very, very different from that at the beginning of the story and through much of the 18th century. And of course, it's the protagonists of the story themselves who tell us this. This is not an argument I need to impose on them or even sort of ferret out of the sources. It's coming through loud and clear. William Penn treats the different Indian groups, the Delawares, the Susquehannocks, the Iroquois, as separate nations. He treats with them as separate nations. They regard themselves as separate nations. And then clearly there are power relations between them, such that the Iroquois, who are based up in present-day upper New York State, are the major players throughout the 18th century. They're power brokers between the English and the French. And the smaller Indian tribes in Pennsylvania, the Delawares were the most important. The Susquehannocks were once important, and the Conestogas were their last remnant. They and other smaller groups are actually tributaries to the Iroquois. Now, to be a tributary means, in a basic sense, that they pay tribute to their masters. Mm-hmm. That could be in the form of deer skins or crops or a token symbol of some sort. But the relationship goes beyond that, because the fundamental feature of the tributary relationship is that the subordinate tribe or nation lacks the power to do two essential things. One is to make war, and the other is to transact in land. Mm-hmm. So anything involving war or landed property must be mediated for that group by the Iroquois, which is why at all the treaties in the 18th century you will see Iroquois representatives. So when the Delawares or the Conestogas are engaged in financial or political business with the government in Philadelphia, the Iroquois are there to monitor the proceedings. All the big decisions are taken with the Iroquois. Frequently, the smaller Indian groups are not consulted about their fate. And ultimately, the Iroquois are major significant players in the imperial history of North America in the 18th century. You have the British and the French contending for mastery. You have the Iroquois mediating quite successfully between them. The Iroquois stay neutral during the French and Indian War, but lean heavily towards the British. During the American Revolution, four of the six nations side with the British. Which is the only side they could have taken, because they were much more afraid of the Americans than the British, with good reason. Mm-hmm. But maybe we'll get back to that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think the whole topic of Indian, sort of European Indian diplomacy is a fascinating one, and a lot is being done on it now. We just hired a fellow, Tom Mitrod is his name, and he's just completed a book on on basically Indian diplomacy. And the sources are fascinating, and because I think a lot of 19th century, early 20th century American historians looked at this, and when they saw Indian, they thought of one thing. They didn't pay attention to the richness of the sources. It was always there. This is what Tom says.
Yeah.
It was always there that they were treating them very differently, but historians just didn't see it. I find that process fascinating. Yeah.
Well, certainly the sources available to me were very rich, and actually one of the ironies in moving back into the 18th century from the 19th, where I began, is I discovered more and more source material, partly because the protagonists, the Paxton Boys, the Presbyterians, being Protestant, tended to write things down, and were literate, highly literate and articulate, partly because the colonial government kept such extensive records of the treaties. Now, the records are problematic, and I could certainly offer an auto-critique of my own usage of them, but it's a calculated decision. And in other words, what you have in the treaty records are sources that were collected in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. So the state governments brought them together in the 19th century. What they brought together were transcriptions written down in the 18th century mm-hmm. in English of translations. Mm-hmm. made at the time of conference proceedings. So you have collections of transcriptions of translations, right? Mm-hmm. So you're at three or four levels removed mm-hmm. from the Indian voice. You do have Indian voices, but you have to understand that these were diplomatic spokesmen who to begin with spoke in a certain ritual form that was then translated. The translation was transcribed. And I'm sure distorted in transcription, sometimes deliberately, and then eventually collected in the 19th century. So it's a third or fourth hand account. And now, I guess when I was younger and when I was doing the Molly Maguire book, and maybe a little more skeptical than I needed to be, I would have said, well, those sources are too compromised, but they're not. They're the only sources we have.
Yeah.
And if you read them carefully, you just learn so much about Indian conceptions of land and culture and Quaker conceptions of Indians and relations between the different Indian groups. They're incredibly rich.
Yeah. I think there's really a lot to be done with them. I do. I know that I worked with a kind of document that was, or a kind of source in my first book that was largely dismissed by 19th century historians, and these were travel accounts. These are people
who had gone from
Western Europe to Muscovy or to 16th and 17th century Russia. And in the 19th century, people said, well, you know, these guys didn't know what they were talking about, and they were translated and they're corrupted in various ways and so on, you know. But if you look at them carefully, though, and compare different, you can actually wring a lot of what I think is true information out of them. And there's really a lot being done with that now. And there's certainly a lot of it in your book.
Yeah.
So
I think so. And we always read sources critically when we do read history. So they have to be read in a certain way. The other thing I would say that struck me most in writing the book, and certainly stands out in the way I've written the book, is if you think of the Iroquois and the other Indians, especially the Iroquois, as being engaged in the same fundamental struggle or game over land and power mm-hmm. as the Penn family, the Quakers, the French, the British imperial government, all of them are interacting on the same terrain. Mm-hmm. The net result of that approach is to de-exoticize the Indians. Now, it could be that an ethnologist would look at my work and say, no, I've gone too far in that respect. Mm-hmm. But in my book, the Indians are just as human as everybody else.
Yeah.
And that's how they come through loud and clear to me. And, you know, this was a new field for me, a new century for me. But this is what came out of the sources for me, is that they were all engaged in a common struggle. And it's a sort of the net effect, as I say, is to de-exoticize.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that on balance is a good thing and a powerful insight. Certainly for me, it was one of the things I learned most from mm-hmm. the project.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I know that when you were talking about the relationship between the Iroquois and these other Indian groups and the these kinds of relation of patron to client, or that's not the right term, but these sorts of relations of suzerainry, I was thinking...
I was thinking
that the... until pretty recently, and I mean pretty recently, the last few hundred years, I believe that the King of England was also the King of France. I don't remember very well, but I'm pretty sure that for a very long time, the King of England claimed to be the King of France.
That's right.
He or she really couldn't enforce that claim very well, but they were still claiming it. And
enforcing the claim is the key thing. There's there's a large element of bluff in what the Iroquois are doing, uh-huh. but they're brilliant diplomatists, and yeah. they do back it up with the threat of military force.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, I like this idea of exoticizing. I can't say it very well, but I think it's terrific. I think you should write an article about it or something.
maybe,
all for it. So let's get to how it. Let's get to the sad part about how it all fell apart. And did it begin to fall apart during the? The war, which has many names, that is the American, what was it, the it's the French-Indian War here, and then it's the Great War for Empire some places and other places.
Yes,
I think it's the Seven Years' War, I can't remember.
The Seven Years' War, or the First War, the First World
First
War.
First World War, whatever we call this thing that occurred in the sort of 1750s.
It fell apart then. It began to fall apart earlier. I mean, you could say the cracks were evident even during Penn's lifetime, mm-hmm. For the reasons we discussed earlier. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's this unstable mixture of benevolence and colonialism, altruism and self-interest. Now, Penn's children are, I guess, a bad lot. Maybe it just comes from inheriting 29 million acres. I mean, what can one expect? But Tom, he has three sons who eventually inherit Pennsylvania. The eldest of them, John the American, because he was born in Philadelphia during one of his father's two visits, he dies, and Thomas Penn becomes the principal proprietor and governor of the province. From the 1730s right through until 1775. He wants to do what his father never managed to do, which is to make money out of the province. He does so as an absentee landlord, and he quickly reverts from Quakerism to Anglicanism, which means that the religious foundation of the peaceable kingdom or the humane vision is gone. And, you know, a very clear sign of this is the one well-known notorious incident I discuss early in the book of the walking purchase in 1737.
Yeah.
So basically, Penn and his brother unearth a document that goes back 50 years, and they say to the Delawares living along the Delaware River, said, well, look, our father purchased this land from you. He gave you the money. But the transaction was never completed. The measure of the land is how much a man can walk in a day and a half, and the walk was never made, so we need to survey the land. Well, the Delawares are mystified because they know exactly how much a man can walk in a day and a half. He can walk from here to a certain creek so many miles distant. But they agree to have the walk conducted anyway under duress, and the Penns send out a team of relay runners to conduct the walk, and they cover circumnavigated territory the size of Rhode Island. And that, so now the Delawares who live there have to leave. It takes 5 years to get them out of there, but who orchestrates their departure? The Iroquois. The Iroquois are now allies with Philadelphia. The Delawares get squeezed out. The Delawares move west of the Susquehanna River. All sorts of interesting things are happening out there, not least including George Washington's efforts on behalf of the Ohio Company to secure land out in what is now western Pennsylvania and Ohio. They come into conflict with the French in the region of Fort Duquesne, which becomes Fort Pittsburgh. And the seeds of the French and Indian War really germinate there. During the French and Indian War, the Western Delaware Indians, who haven't forgotten the walking purchase, really side with the French as the lesser of two evils. They'd rather there was no war. It's not their war. It's a war between two alien powers, but the least threatening of those powers is the French. Mainly because the French don't have the manpower to actually plant extensive settlements in the interior. The British clearly do. So they side with the French. They launch devastating punitive raids back into interior Pennsylvania across the Susquehanna River. And what happens next is decisive because war has come to the peaceable kingdom. The peaceable kingdom is still sufficiently Quaker that it has no means of self-defense. It has no militia. So the first thing they have to do with Benjamin Franklin No, actually, he had done it, tried to do it a little earlier. Franklin comes back into the story later. But the first thing they do is they set up a militia, a fighting force. Now, Quakers had been, ever since the opening decade of the 18th century, they had been prepared to vote funds in the assembly for what they euphemistically called the King's Youth. Mm-hmm. In other words, that's a way of getting of skirting the question of pacifism and saying, okay, we'll vote to provide funds to the king and he can use them for whatever he wants. In other words, if he uses them to defend us in a war, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But now, for the first time, the peaceable kingdom sets up its own fighting force and Pennsylvanians will be taking up arms. Now, to take up arms as a Quaker is, from a strict pacifist point of view, in other words, from William Penn's point of view, it would have been anathema. There still are strict pacifists in Pennsylvania, most notably the Pemberton family, mm-hmm. Israel Pemberton, who refused to go along with this. But the great majority of Quakers by the 1750s are no longer strict pacifist under the pressure of attacks from on the province for the first time. The province responds. It declares war on the Delaware Indians. It even provides scalp bounties for the capture or killing of Indians. And you could say by 1756, at the very latest, the peaceable kingdom is no more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how do we get from there to the Paxton Boys?
Well, the Paxton Boy episode takes place in 1763, mm-hmm. now, which is a great turning point in American history. It's the beginning of the Revolutionary Era, and it is also, in terms of this local history, a particular beginning to Pennsylvania's Revolution, which we'll talk about. But 1763 is the end of the Seven Years' War, which is the global war of which the French and Indian War is a part.
Mm-hmm.
The Peace of Paris is signed in 1763. We often date the beginning of the Revolutionary Era to then, because the British had to figure out ways of paying for the war. Mm-hmm. They had to impose new taxes that were very familiar with the Stamp Act and mm-hmm. All of that. They imposed a Western barrier on British settlement. In other words, they drew a proclamation line and said, east of this is English territory, west of it is American territory, and all of that outrages the type of people I described earlier who are living on the frontier in the mm-hmm. Susquehanna Valley. Now, the other thing that happens in 1763 is the largest Indian rebellion in colonial American history, and that is Pontiac's War.
Mm-hmm.
And that originates up in the Great Lakes region, but quickly spreads down all the way down to the Ohio Valley in Pennsylvania. And once again, Delaware and Shawnee Indians begin to cross the Susquehanna River and attack Pennsylvania. On the front line, of course, are the Ulster Scots, mm-hmm. the Presbyterians, the squatters, the wild man.
mm-hmm.
And from their perspective, they are reliving the nightmare of the French and Indian War once again, and the government in Philadelphia, both the Quaker-dominated assembly and the Penn family, which controls the executive, are doing virtually nothing to protect them,
mm-hmm.
because Pennsylvania disbanded its militia in 1758, once the Pennsylvania phase of the French and Indian War came to an end.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is under pressure from the frontiersmen, the Philadelphia government authorizes the creation of a new provincial militia for defensive purposes, both east and west of the Susquehanna River. And the group on both sides of the river in what is today Harrisburg, it was at that point Harris's Ferry, mm-hmm. where an Englishman named Harris ran a ferry across the river. In that particular region, Harrisburg, Lancaster region, also the area of Paxton Presbyterian Church, the militiamen are known as the Paxtang Rangers, mm-hmm. P-A-X-T-A NG, which is just another spelling for Paxton, the Paxton Rangers or the Paxton Boys. Mm-hmm. Their commander, though he doesn't fight in the field, is quite elderly, but the man in charge of raising them is the Reverend John Elder, the fighting pastor of Paxton Presbyterian Church. He had fought during the French and Indian War. My understanding of what happens is that this particular frontier militia group, the Paxton Rangers or Paxton Boys, which is organized for strictly defensive purposes, mm-hmm. Quickly exceeds its mandate and launches offensive attacks usually on Delaware Indians living in Moravian settlements. That's their principal target. Mm-hmm. Those attacks fail for complicated reasons. They're repulsed by other Indians. And the Paxton Boys turn around and they say, well, look, there's this group of Indians, the Conestogas. Now, by this time, there are only 20 of them left, but they are a remnant of the Susquehannock Indians who were once very powerful in the region. They've been living on Conestoga Manor for over 70 years. They were actually given land there by William Penn and have been living under government protection. That's the protection of the Penn family ever since. And this is the target they choose.
And I was going to say, and some of them are also Christians, aren't they?
Yes. Now, the Indians they initially attacked were definitely Moravian Indians, which is, in other words, converted to Christianity by Moravian missionaries. Yeah. There's no evidence that the Conestoga Indians were actually Christian.
Okay. Right.
I've seen it written down, but I found no evidence that they had converted. But they were peaceful, absolutely peaceful, on very good relations with the Penn family. They revered William Penn and his memory. They conveyed the same honorific title on his sons. They lived under government protection. There's immense symbolic significance in what the Paxton Boys do because they choose to attack in broad daylight a group of peaceful, non-belligerent Indians who live on government-owned land under government protection. Mm-hmm. They kill the first six of them on December 14, 1763. About 50 Paxton Boys ride downriver. It's quite a ride, almost 40 miles. And they must have ridden through the night or broken their journey the day before. They attack Conestoga Indian Town. Only six of the Indians are present. The other 14 are out selling brooms and baskets that they make and is one of their few sources of a livelihood. The authorities remove the remaining 14, including the eight children, to nearby Lancaster Workhouse. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, the Paxton Boys strike again. They break into Lancaster Workhouse, and in a matter of minutes, they slaughter the remaining 14 Indians. Again, it's government-owned property. It's broad daylight. Mm-hmm. Plenty of evidence in the book to indicate that the authorities had some inkling of what was going to happen on both occasions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, the ultimate symbolic significance of this, in addition to what I've just mentioned, is that essentially the Paxton Boys are throwing down the gauntlet to the government. They're saying all Indians are the same. Doesn't matter. We reject your distinction between enemy Indians and friendly Indians. They deserve to be annihilated. We've done it. They even claim the land as theirs by right of conquest. Mm-hmm. And then they throw down the gauntlet and they say, well, what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm. And what do they do about it?
Nothing. The Paxton Boys are never investigated, arrested, prosecuted, tried. Nothing. And mm-hmm. so carte blanche to like-minded frontier settlers on the front in the West. It's open season on Indians.
Uh-huh. And do the Quakers, they mount no sort of effort to prosecute the Paxton Boys? Do they seek help from London in this instance? Do they say, you know, could you come help us out with this?
Yeah, they did. In a manner of speaking, they seek help from London. They contacted the commander-in-chief of British forces in North America and secured military reinforcement for the city of Philadelphia.
And this is Gage at this time, is that right?
Later even better known.
Yes, much better known, right, in Boston, yeah.
Yes.
Did the British come to the aid of the Quakers in Philadelphia?
Adequately. They sent a few detachments down from New York. It was important that they do so because about a month after the two massacres that I've just described, rumors arise in Philadelphia that the Paxton Boys, perhaps as many as 1,500 of them, are marching across the frozen landscape of Lancaster Plain from the Susquehanna Valley and are intent on sacking the city of Philadelphia. A number of Indians, about 140 Moravian Indians, have been removed to Philadelphia for their safety. The Paxton Boys demand the right to, quote-unquote, inspect them. Now, what an inspection might have consisted of, given what they've just done to the Conestoga Indians, doesn't bear thinking about. So they march on the city. Probably about 300 of them arrive in the town of Germantown, which is about 8 miles, I think, outside the then center of the city. John Penn, the governor, he's the grandson of William Penn, sends out a delegation of ministers from different faiths to talk to them, and then he sends out a delegation led by Benjamin Franklin. Franklin persuades the spokesman of the Paxton Boys to write their grievances down, and they submit two documents, a declaration, which was probably written before they got to Germantown, and then a more formally constructed remonstrance, listing their grievances. Now, they do, in one of the grievances, talk about lack of political representation in the West, and historians have made a big deal about that and talked about them as progenitors of democracy in the Revolution, and that's a theme we could discuss as well. It's true in one sense. But seven of the eight grievances in the remonstrances deal with Indian affairs, defense, and their very grim and dim opinion of Indians. So Franklin persuades them to write it down and to disband. They go back to the frontier, their spokesmen stay, and they present the declaration and the remonstrance. The Quaker-dominated assembly wants an investigation. They want the leaders, the ringleaders who are known of the Paxton Boys, brought into the city and interrogated. They want a commission. John Penn says no. He cites, arcane constitutional reasons. He says the Paxton Boys can't be dictating what we do and do not do. But it's politically quite complicated because the Quaker Assembly and the Penn executive branch have been at loggerheads for many, many years over many, many issues. But a third force has emerged into Pennsylvania politics by this time, and that is a Presbyterian faction. The Presbyterians within the city of Philadelphia and in the West are becoming more powerful. And really, you get a lineup then of the Anglican proprietary family and the Presbyterians against the Quakers and Benjamin Franklin. And the result, instead of an actual battle in Philadelphia or a war, is instead a war of words, a pamphlet war, an extraordinary exchange of over 60 pamphlets and 10 political cartoons where they all go after each other hell for leather and blame one another for the mess. Franklin has the inspired but ultimately not so inspired idea that the solution to this would be to abolish proprietary government. So far, so good. but to place Pennsylvania under the direct rule of the crown.
Yeah.
So royal government. Now, of course, it sounds very ironic to us because 12 years later, he'll at the forefront of a movement to abolish direct rule by the crown.
Any port in a storm.
There is a consistency because his target is the same in both cases. It's arcane proprietary privilege. It happens to be the Penn family the first time and monarchy as such the second time.
Yeah. Right, I see. So what is the legacy of the I was going to ask you about the legacy of the Paxton Boys and the failure, I guess I should say, or destruction of Penn's experiment for the Revolution, but I'm more interested in the final few minutes to hear you talk about what the legacy of This is for the Indian groups that were in the area.
Long term or 18th century?
Well, 18th century and then long term.
I'll try both. I think the first and second question actually are connected because the what happens in the revolution determines the fate of the Indians as well. The Paxton Boys go underground after the massacres and the march in Philadelphia. They reemerge on the eve of the revolution, and they reemerge as patriots. It's an odd and convoluted story, but it's worth touching on. At this time, the colony of Connecticut was seeking to expand its sway by moving westward and by planting a colony actually in northern Pennsylvania. Now, it did that on the basis of its original colonial charter, which had no western boundary. It's a sea-to-sea charter, just like Virginia's is and many of the other charters. It extends theoretically from the Atlantic to the Pacific. A chunk of land called part of New York is already taken, so they leapfrog that and say, okay, well, let's take part of what's Pennsylvania. They approach Lazarus Stewart, a man named Lazarus Stewart, who was the leader of the Paxton Boy expeditions in 1763, and said, look, you still need land. We'll give you land if you work as mercenaries for us against Pennsylvania. Paxton Boys are delighted to do that, and so they go up there, they drive out the Pennsylvania settlers, and they secure northern Pennsylvania for Connecticut. That's right on the eve of the Revolution. They start to call themselves patriots, and they're doing battle with the arch-Tory, Thomas Penn. Then the Revolution comes. It's a matter really of settling grievances, and local grievances again over land, and it involves Indians, because in 1778... Loyalist forces under General John Butler enter northern Pennsylvania's Wyoming Valley, where the Paxton Boys and the Connecticut forces are, and the Paxton Boys decide to do battle. They march out to meet them, and they are annihilated. Almost 200 of them are killed. It's called the Wyoming Massacre. That's the end of the Paxton Boys. They died as patriots. Fighting on the revolutionary side, the patriot side. They died as they had lived, fighting Tories and Indians over land. Now, events like that help trigger a major concerted American backlash against the Loyalists and the Indians. Remember, four of the six nations in the Iroquois Confederacy have allied themselves with the British. So the Americans launch scorched earth campaigns up through Iroquois country and out into western Pennsylvania. They devastate, destroy villages, devastate everything in sight. In 1783, you have the second Peace of Paris, the more familiar one that ends the Revolutionary War. All Indian territory, Iroquois territory, and other Indians who had allied themselves with the British, between the Mississippi and the East Coast, north of Florida, south of Canada, are forfeited by right of conquest to the new American nation. The inhabitants of those lands are never consulted. So that's the ultimate and, I guess, the sad or grim conclusion of the story, where the fate of Native Americans and the impact of the Paxton Boys come together. I think you could say that in that sense, the Revolution is the Paxton Boy episode writ large. And in that, and it's in that sense that the Paxton Boys actually are progenitors of the Revolution, the hard side of the Revolution. There's great irony here, because Pennsylvania really is the center of the Revolution and the formation of the Constitution. It puts into place the most radical experiments in Republican democracy. But all of that rests on the expulsion or annihilation of Indians, just as American freedom in Virginia, in Jefferson's Virginia, rested on the fact of slavery. And that's the strong and inescapable conclusion that comes through. I would just say in conclusion that there is a legacy also left, I think, by William Penn. The scale of the devastation in Pennsylvania at the end of the 18th century is such that in the 19th and 20th centuries, Pennsylvania's the people of Pennsylvania believed that there were no Indians living there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was largely true. There were some who had gone into hiding in remote regions. But it's an extreme form of what we call the myth of the vanishing Indian, nonetheless.
Yeah, right.
Because in 1700, where my story more or less begins, the best count we have is that there were about 5,000 Native Americans left. Mm-hmm. There had been many more 100 years earlier.
Yeah.
If you look at Pennsylvania today, there are over 20,000 Pennsylvanians who identify themselves as Native American.
Yeah.
There are more than that number who claim partial Native American ancestry. At the same time, Pennsylvania has no state or federal recognition of any tribe.
Is that right?
And it has no reservation of any kind.
Well, shame on them.
Well, I wrote an op-ed about this in the Philadelphia Inquirer a few months ago, and that's where William Penn, in a way, does come back in. Sometimes the past is not relevant to the present,
yeah.
But the idea of little commonwealths peacefully coexisting among us is actually strikingly similar to federal policy on the recognition. There are over 500 Indian tribes and nations recognized in the United States today, as you could say, as little commonwealths existing between state and federal power.
It's funny because I was going to say we've taken up a lot of your time, and I really appreciate it. And I know you have to go.
Probably more than you can use.
No, not at all. Yeah, but I did. Yeah, you know, yeah. Absolutely. This is absolutely fascinating to me, and I think that it's fascinating to all Americans. I'm a big fan of having other people, and I don't mean that in any sort of big O Michel Foucault kind of way. Other people, overseas write our history because people who are not Americans see everything differently. And I know that every time I talk to an American historian, and particularly about the American Revolutionary era, it's just a long process by which I unlearn the things that I learned in high school. I mean, it's incredible how if you read books like yours.
Yeah,
the scales just fall from your eyes, and you realize how hard it was to keep your nose and hands clean by our age in that era.
Yeah.
It was almost impossible. And these people, you know, I think you put it really well. I mean, the Indians were people, and the Mennonites were people, and the Quakers were people, and they unfortunately act like people. And, you know,
as you said at the beginning, you know, well, don't recall exactly how you put it. I mean, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah, it's very hard to keep your hands clean here.
I have to say, though, when I published the piece in the op-ed in the Philadelphia Inquirer just a couple of months ago, you know, I got about 25 or 30 direct email responses
mm-hmm.
from people who read it that morning, mm-hmm. and only two of them were negative. One was a crank. And the other said, okay, but what's the point? Why are you telling us this? What are we going to do about it? But it was really interesting to get the responses. And I did eventually get one or two responses from Pennsylvanians who are Native Americans
mm-hmm.
who were really, really pleased. And they said all they want to say is that we still exist.
Right. I mean, I think the thing that we need to bear in mind as historians is that, you know, our job is to tell the story in the most correct way possible.
And
that's really what you've done here. I mean, I think it was George Will or somebody who said that the power of myths has nothing to do with their truth. But we're not about myths in what we do. We're about telling the truth. And this one is pretty uncomfortable. I mean, if you're an American and you read this book, probably will need to go take a shower after you're done. I recommend you read it, though. It's extraordinarily interesting. I think you've done a fantastic job. Anyway, I should tell everybody that we've been talking to Kevin Kenney about his book, Peaceable Kingdom Lost, The Paxton Boys, and Destruction of William Penn's Holy Experiment. Kevin, thanks very much for being on the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Marshall. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Kevin Kenney about his book, Peaceable Kingdom Lost, The Paxton Boys, and the Destruction of William Penn's Holy Experiment. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.